You're listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Good morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you are, Tennis.com podcast. From an electrically lit office in New York City, I am Ed McGrogan here with Richard Pagliaro. Both of us suffering the ill effects of a unseasonably snowy October. Candlelight, all that. It's actually true if you're hearing us from afar. It's not one of those media-created stories to drive up oil or any of those things that actually happened. So we're glad to be both here talking with you. You know, have the sweaters on, of course. It is pretty brisk up here in these parts. So good to have you. And we did, you know, catch as much as we could of the tennis this weekend, the primary event being the WTA Championships in Istanbul, which wrapped up. Petra Kvitova wins that tournament. She beats Victoria Azarenka in the final. And we'll talk about both of those two here. Kvitova went through the tournament without losing a match. Azarenka dropped one match in the round robin. It was a meaningless one to Marion Bartoli. Richard, just about those two, I think we always like to, when we have a year-end season-ending tournament here, we like to predict, you know, this is just these two players really sizing up for an even bigger next season, in this case 2012. Azarenka doesn't have a slam. Kvitova, you know, has one. She won Wimbledon. I guess, what do you take going away from this term particular for both of these two?
Well, I mean, if you're Wozniacki, you're hearing footsteps and you're hearing them fast, because I think Kvitova's will definitely, barring injury or just, you know, unable to deal with the pressure, I think she'll definitely be the next number one. And yeah, I think she's going to win another major, maybe a couple next year. Although, you know, it's difficult to say because you have Clijsters coming back and the Williams sisters, and I don't discount any of those players. But I think what Kvitova showed you is that not only the completeness of the game, but her power is a very easy power. And I think once she learns to channel that and control it and realize, look, you don't have to go for the winner every shot, it's just going to make her fastball that much faster. So, undefeated indoors, look dominant. I think she's the real deal.
Yeah, there is a post on our ticker talking about the points that separate Wozniacki from Kvitova, Azarenka, even Sharapova. They're all very close. And this is where this past year Wozniacki had most of her titles. In the early spring, and it looks like you're saying almost assured that Kvitova will pass her. It would take really sort of an epic collapse not for that to happen. For Azarenka, I think about her. I think a lot of people talk about Azarenka and they say that she still doesn't really have that finishing touch weapon that can make her baseline game really a dominant game over players. And I almost wonder if she is, in a way, caught up in the same situation that Wozniacki is, really sort of a baseline heavy player. She might be more aggressive, I suppose, than Wozniacki, but should we be talking about those two really in the same light? They're both kind of looking for the big breakthrough. You know, they've won pretty much everything else, but they don't have that really, go-to weapon.
I think another common similarity between Wozniacki and Azarenka is they're both best on hard court. So I'd like to see her develop a little. I mean, I know she got to the Madrid final this year and she's had other good results on clay, but I'd like to see her sort of translate that to other surfaces. I think she's more offensive than Wozniacki, and I think she's more actively looking to end the point quicker than Wozniacki. So I think her offensive skills are a little bit better. I just think Wozniacki, to this point in their careers, has been mentally tougher. Mm-hmm. The days where she doesn't have it or she's not feeling it, more often she finds a way to sort of fight through. Although, if she loses number one early, you wonder what kind of impact that could have. Maybe it'll liberate her where she won't have to deal with the questions anymore, or maybe it'll be like, geez, it's going to be a climb to get back there.
Right. One player also who I think, besides Kvitova, who I think has a really good next season lined up, I was very impressed with. I was sort of validated in a way, was Stozer, who I picked at the beginning to win the event, and she did. She made the final four. She was the she took a set off of Kvitova. Sorry, she was the first player to do so, and I do think that you know, kind of like with Kvitova, you have a very serve-based game, and she really, I think she's also kind of a pretty mentally strong player at this point after what we saw at the U.S. Open, of course, with her taking out Serena in the final there, and so I don't think you can question that, right? I do think that Stozer might not be a one-and-done player either, also for the reason that she still is only a singles committed player. She's had lots of doubles under her belt, which may help her, you know, physically as well. But I also think she has a big appetite still, you know, for what remains. So I think I see a good 2012 for Stozer as well. I don't know if there's any other players you're thinking about for down the road or any other takeaways from the WTA.
I tend to agree with you on Stozer. It's been tough for her to sort of put those results up in Australia because she's from Australia. People expect so much about her. But I think on the upside with her is that, you know, she was number one in the world in doubles, and I still don't see her using all those double skills as much as she possibly could in singles. And I think what I saw from her last week that was really encouraging is how she managed the backhand, and she just played it back deep. When she had a scrap and slice it back, she did what she had to do. And then when she got the she was patient to get the forehand and not sort of force matters. But I think when she takes the volley in the transition game that she has shown you in doubles to the singles court, I think she's got a higher ceiling than we've seen. And obviously beating Serena in a Grand Slam final on her home soil, I mean, that does wonders for your kind. If you can beat Serena in the United States in a major final, I mean, you got to like your chances against anybody, you know, in any final.
Yeah. Now here we have, this is the last point we'll make about the women today, and then we'll go to the men here. But we've had this whole big discussion here about you know, what's coming forward for the women's tour in 2012. And the only mention of Serena Williams has been just what we're saying, being defeated by Stozer. We haven't mentioned Kim Clijsters at all, who not 10 months ago looked like she could win the Grand Slam conceivably. There's still Venus Williams, of course. I guess the last question I have is, what do you really expect from these veterans going forward? I think you can kind of group them all into one segment, at least in my opinion, that they all seem to be looking at the last sort of runs for their careers, I think, in different ways. But do you expect them sort of like this year to really sort of, once they come back, they assume their spot and that's just how good they are? Or do you think we're entering kind of a different era?
I think with Serena and Clijsters, I don't think the number one ranking matters to them as much. I mean, sure, they take it if the results put them there, but I don't think they're playing for number one. I think they're both playing for majors. And people say to me, well, geez, how can you keep talking about Serena? You know, she only plays 3-4 months a year. But I mean, come on, wake up. Look at the last 3-4 years of her career. She's been a sporadic player, and when she's there playing and committed to playing, she could play with anybody. So to me, Serena, if she stays healthy and stays motivated, she's got another 3 to 5 years. She's only 30, and the mileage on her body is not nearly what it is for other 30-year-olds, simply because she rarely plays, you know, a 10-month schedule. She just doesn't. Some of that is illness, an injury that she's had, but some of it is just, that's just her scheduling. So I think for them, they're always, I mean, at least for the foreseeable future, they're going to be forces at the majors, and I don't think number one is really a priority for either one of them. They've sort of been there, done that, and I don't think they need the sort of other
validation, you know,
responsibility and validation that goes along with it. I think it's not a goal.
Yeah. Now, in a very, I think, symbolic way, this week we have two really loaded men's tournaments here. The women's season, for all intents and purposes, is through. There is the Fed Cup final coming up later this weekend. That obviously still warrants coverage. There's also a second year, sort of like a minor league year-end tournament in Bali, Indonesia, which I don't think is going to merit much of any coverage, and probably deservedly so in a way. It's sort of an odd placement after the actual year-end championships, but on the men's side, before the London event, which is their year-end championship, begins, there's a lot of interesting warm-up events for that. The last Masters is next week in Paris. This week in Valencia and Basel, both 500-level ATP tournaments. These are some substantial draws. In Basel, you have Djokovic, who returns first time since Davis Cup. Federer, same thing. Murray takes a wild card in the tournament. Berdych, Marty Fish, Janko Tipsarevic, Andy Roddick, Viktor Troicki, those are just the seeds. You look at the unseeded players, it's really impressive. And the same can be said for Valencia. Both tournaments, actually, all of their seeded players are in the top 20. Valencia, you have Ferrer. Is Sanga playing this? Because he is number two in this.
I'm not sure.
Not sure if he would, but he did just
beat
Del Potro, who was also in this. Simone, who's actually already out of this as of this recording. Almagro, Monfils, Dolgopolov, Feliciano Lopez. Again, some very big unseeded players too. Query, Isner, Verdasco's unseeded. It's really remarkable. Kind of the men are just waiting for these two tournaments for their big year-end push. I guess out of these two, what's kind of the thing? I think I know the answer. The returns of really Djokovic, Federer, especially. I guess what do you expect from those two?
Boy, it's hard to say just because Federer hasn't won a title since January. You know, you know
it's an amazing stat. Amazing. That he's only won one title.
Totally amazing. I mean, astounding. Yeah. I mean, you expect him to be super hungry, and he always plays well in his hometown. Djokovic has had good results in Basel too, so you wonder those two basically skipping the whole Asian swing. How that's going to play out, if they're going to be sort of rested and refreshed, or a little rusty, or a combination of all the above. To me, Murray's the story there because the guy was just so dominant in Asia, and you see no reason why he wouldn't sort of continue that. And all the comments I'm reading from him, he sounds hungry and he sounds motivated. So it'll be interesting if either of those two run into Murray, how that'll go down.
Yeah, you look at the draws here, these are essentially like Masters level draws.
Sure.
Both these. If you take Murray, for example, I read this somewhere, he opens with Haas. He could play Wawrinka, who's unseeded in his second match.
And he beat Murray at the Open a couple years ago.
Right. Tipsarevic, who you mentioned, is
on
playing
fire.
Everything in sight, and he is on fire. He could play him in the quarters, the semis, has Federer, of course, Djokovic in the final, depending on how Djokovic looks. It's a really, really strong draw, and we're going to have a preview of both of those Tuesday officially.
And if you're Federer, not just because of the title drought, but also because London coming up, where he's obviously got the points on the table, it's important for him to get off well here, obviously, not just because it's his hometown, but because of what's coming up as well.
And to me, as I've said all along, I still feel like not enough attention can be paid to what Djokovic still can achieve with this season. It seems like a long time ago since we've last talked about that. The U.S. Open, it's over a month and a half ago, which in tennis terms is 5 years ago, it seems like. But if somehow he ended up winning this term, I think it is sort of unrealistic to think that, considering how good this field is and what the last we've seen of Djokovic. But if he ended up winning this tournament, and you get on that whole train right back on it about, are we watching the best season of all time, really? And we'll have a Masters to go and then London. It really does shape up. It's a pretty exciting period here for men's fans.
Especially given his performance in Masters events this year, it's mind-blowing. I mean, it's unprecedented, really. You look at what he's done in Masters events. So I'm interested to see how he carries that into Paris, where traditionally that surface plays usually the fastest among the second half Masters events.
Yep. Yeah. So we're going to be, as I said, looking at both of those tournaments this week. Big full preview tomorrow, Tuesday, from Steve Tignor here on tennis.com. We're going to have a lot of coverage of both of those on our blogs, the Racket Reaction blog, etc. So please tune in for that, and we'll talk to you next time here on the podcast. For Richard Pegliaro, I am Ed McGrogan. Thanks for listening.
You've been enjoying Tennis.com's weekly podcast. Thanks for listening. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.